Today's sponsor is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shark. Welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks Podcast. I'm your host, John Lossoff. Joining me, as always, are my co-hosts, Mark Hoffmeyer.
I had an amazing realization the other day.
Really?
Yeah. So I was watching Elvis and Nixon, and I realized that my favorite actors, right now, my three favorite actors, Michael Shannon, Bruce Campbell, and Kurt Russell, have all played Elvis.
Shit. Wait, when did Michael Shannon play Elvis?
He's Elvis and Elvis Nixon this year.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I haven't seen it.
Yeah. And then I also realized that my other favorite actor, Dolph Lundgren, sang A Little Less Conversation at a Swedish award show where he also did karate. And then I realized that Patrick Wilson, one of my favorite actors, sang Elvis in Conjuring 2. So it's weird.
So it all comes back to Elvis.
Is what also, your favorite show, Full House, features Jesse Kasopoulos, who loves Elvis.
That's right.
Robert Lamb, say hi to everyone.
Hey, everyone. I'm a huge fan of John Stamos.
Yeah. You don't even know who Elvis is.
Yeah. You know what? I watch Full House so much, and Jesse Kasopoulos, some may know as John Stamos, used to mention this guy Elvis all the time. And I was like, who is this fellow that keeps getting mentioned? And I went back. I did a little research on my encyclopedia because I don't own the internet. And I went through and I flipped through and I found Elvis in there. And I read a little bit about his bio. And now I get it. Now I get it all. I get all the music references and everything.
If you were somewhere and someone was joking around, they went, Elvis has left the building. You would be like, who?
I would be like, good. Robert's about to leave too. So, I mean, do we have to announce it when we leave? That's what I would think.
Hey, guys, I'm out.
Kevin's leaving the building. John entered the building. Like, I mean, come on, guys. Chill out. People come
really
and go all the time.
Slope when you
Robert.
Start that.
Robert's really fun at parties, folks.
I'm usually,
what can I say?
I'm usually right at the front door just announcing who comes in and who comes out.
Yeah. And he's next to the CD player that he still has, the boombox, and he like guards it with his life.
Yeah. Shockingly, it's always playing Burning Love, which turns out to be an Elvis song.
And you're like a real big music purist, so you have to play through the entire album, like A side and B side.
Yep.
Yeah.
Like, there's no, you're a terrible DJ, but you love it.
Oh, yeah. I think I'm good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Mark. I think it's time to start the podcast like we usually do with listener questions. I think you got questions for us this week.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I sent out, some things. You know, I asked for Alfred Hitchcock questions since that's the theme of this week.
Spoiler. Come on.
save that for the end.
He is the man. the Shyamalan twist.
Yeah. Hey, guys, I don't know if you noticed, but this whole podcast, we've been talking about Hitchcock.
Oh, man.
Oh, no.
And a lot of people had no questions, and it really bothered me because Hitchcock is amazing. But Christopher Kelly, longtime listener, sent me three very impassioned questions. So the first one is, do you think Hitchcock was trying to be creative or was he trying to sell a mediocre story with Rope? So Rope is a movie that's basically, it looks like it's filmed in one take, but they basically just did 10-minute takes and then they would go behind a chair and then.
But that's because they had to, right? Like they couldn't, because it was real film, they only had 10 to 15 minutes of reel that they could put into the camera at the time.
Yeah, and it's basically these two guys kill somebody, stuff him in a chest, and then they throw a party because they're just so into having murdered somebody than enjoying it. And throughout the night, Jimmy Stewart sort of figures it out. But I mean, I loved it. I like that. I like that they killed this dude. They got away with it, and then they had to feed their own vanity. Mm-hmm. I thought it was kind of a good story. But I do think that a lot of movies, like, what's the Leonardo DiCaprio movie where he's in a puddle?
Titanic.
The Revenant. Okay. That movie has whistles on top of bells on top of whistles. And, like, the story is just like a plain revenge or gravities. A woman survives a wreck.
Right.
So I do think a lot of these one-take films that rely on, like, long narratives, I'm not saying Revenant really does that, but it does have long takes. I think their stories are pretty simple. And the whole thing is kind of based around the long
take. I don't think there's anything wrong with having a simplistic story as long as there's still some substance to it. And I think like movies like The Revenant, or even I think like Mad Max has like a simplistic story, but it's just done well. And I think Rope was done well. I don't think that kind of movie could be made today unless it was like on the indie scene. Like there's no way like that kind of movie would be major release, I think.
Yeah, with like Ethan Hawke.
Well, like I know, yeah, Ethan.
the Duplass brothers.
Well, it's interesting because I remember reading a book. Yeah, this one time I read a book, and it was I think it was called it clearly. Yeah, yeah.
But then halfway through, you remembered it was upside down.
Yeah. And I was wondering why I didn't know any of the words, but no, Paul Newman. It was a book, Sidney Lumet or whatever. It's called Making Movies. And it was about, like, all the movies he made. And one of them was he talked to Paul Newman when he was making The Verdict, I think it was. And Paul Newman hated that new movies couldn't have, like, a scene that lasted more than 3 minutes. He's like, why do all these scenes have to cut from, like, minute to minute? Because, you know, like, a lot of movies, not just action movies, just dramas, too. Like, there's not a lot of long takes in movies as there once were, like, in older films. Especially we watch these Alfred Hitchcock movies, and a lot of them, you know, they'll take, like, a long time where there's just, like, monologue after monologue. And that doesn't happen. And Paul Newman's, like, missed the days of just like remembering 5 to 6 to 7 pages of a script because it all took place in one area.
You know what's kind of weird is I was actually thinking about that, and you know, that led me to a really weird movie, that movie Tusk.
Oh yeah, the
by Kevin Smith.
Long. Yeah, mm-hmm.
But like, there's really long monologues in that by Michael Parks, and so like that's like the last movie. Like old school monologue heavy, aside from like Tarantino, Hateful Eight, like just uninterrupted monologues.
Yeah, which doesn't happen too often in film. Yeah. But like you watch a movie like Rope, where it's all taking place in one area, that he is only cutting every 10 to 15 minutes, and only because he has to. Otherwise, he probably would do one long take.
Yeah. I know there was the Russian Ark was filmed on a Steadicam. There's another movie that came out a couple years ago that was all one take. But yeah, Reddit today, movies Reddit, it said that the Russo brothers, there's a 1.8 second scene of Black Panther tackling somebody, and they shot it from 3 different angles.
Oh my god.
So like 1.8 seconds, it's like 3 different shots. Yeah. I love that movie, but you're right, like it's I don't know, I like the idea of Rope. I've always liked the idea of it. Like, not just the rope itself. Like, I like the movie.
But do you think it's a gimmick to have it filmed all in one shot? Like, that wasn't a necessity. It wasn't like he had to do it that way. I think it's cool, and I think it would have been really cool if it was all one take. Can you imagine doing, like, an hour and a half movie all in one shot?
Like, I do think it was a gimmick, but I do think that Hitchcock liked pushing the boundaries of cinema. Like, mm-hmm. When you think about the special effects and North by Northwest, Psycho, The Birds. People may laugh at them now, but at the time, they were groundbreaking. So I think he liked to do stuff like that. He liked to push himself as a director.
Yeah. I mean, you think about The Birds, where he actually used a lot of birds that were trained, and then, like, Psycho, where you're killing off the main character halfway through the movie, and, like you're saying, North by Northwest. Like, it's just, like, all the stuff, like, that whole final climax on Mount Rushmore, like they had to build these huge sets. Like he pushes the boundaries. So I think it is a gimmick, but I don't know if it even really, like, you know, works for the story. It doesn't really have to be that way, but I think the story's not simplistic in a bad way. I think it's actually like a decent story.
And I was thinking about this, the box that the body's in, it's pretty much in frame the entire time.
Mm-hmm. Don't they eat on it? They eat on it, right? They want to like serve dinner on it?
Yeah, it's like all over the place. And so I think the waste, like I think the one way that that could really work to keep it always there and build the suspense is to maybe always have the cameras rolling, like a nice big wide shot on it.
Right. Yeah.
But it doesn't have to be one take. But I like that it's always there.
Right.
It's like the, what is it, suspense that he talks about where he said that, surprise is where a bomb explodes under a table, but then suspense is when you know the bomb's under the table. And you just watch the two people have dinner, even though you know the bomb is there.
That's the thing is,
I think that adds a lot.
Alfred Hitchcock would always say, yeah, you show the audience the bomb, but you don't show the characters in the movie the bomb. That way it is more suspenseful that way because the audience knows that it's there, but the characters don't. And they start worrying for the characters.
So, I don't know. I like the idea. I think he was trying to be creative. So,
mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And
definitely.
He sold the story. Well, so then the next story, the next question is, would you say that Jimmy Stewart is to Hitchcock as De Niro or Leo is to Scorsese?
Yeah, but so Alfred Hitchcock
doesn't. I read an interesting quote.
Yeah.
So there's a quote that he used. He said, I like to use a big star, he said, because you can leave out the first reel, which establishes the character, the audience. So from what I'm guessing is he liked to use these big stars that he had worked with because they don't bother him. But also they were sort of not totally typecasted, but people knew the character. But I think with Scorsese and in regards to De Niro and Leo, they've played more types of characters. I know Jimmy Stewart kind of did Rear Window and Vertigo.
Mm-hmm. But and he was in Rope.
He was in Rope. Yeah. And I just think – I think they're comfortable with each other. But also I don't think it's the same – like they're comfortable, but I don't think it's the same dynamic.
But I heard that – and then this could just be a rumor because there's like a lot of rumors around Alfred Hitchcock and his directing and everything. But – I heard that he didn't really care for Jimmy Stewart that much. He actually liked Cary Grant a lot more. Jimmy Stewart wanted the role in North by Northwest, and Alfred Hitchcock really wanted Cary Grant. And Jimmy Stewart, I think, was kind of hurt by that or something. That's what I've read.
Well, in the past.
Team Stewart or Team Grant?
Yeah, which one? I'm Team Jacob.
Oh, okay.
So it's pretty interesting. Hitchcock was working with Jimmy Stewart, I believe, on Rear Window. And they were kind of talking about North by Northwest. And Jimmy Stewart was like, wow, thinking he got the role. And Hitchcock was really stressed out about it because he didn't want to tell him no because he wanted Cary Grant. So he waited till Stewart got on another movie, what, Anatomy of a Murder?
Ooh.
And then he offered him the role, and then he couldn't get out of it. So he's like, oh, I got to go with Cary Grant.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, so he waited until he got another movie. The thing is, you can never trust what comes out of Hitchcock's mouth because, I mean, he was definitely a perennial bullshitter. So,
and a prankster.
And a what?
Prankster.
Yeah, he was like a big-time prankster.
And a baller.
He was kind of creepy at moments. But so I read a lot of different stuff about him. One guy said that, you know, he actually did have a lot of writers. His writing process, Alfred Hitchcock, was really extreme. So when they shot, everything was just there to shoot, so the studios couldn't mess with it. But Hitchcock never liked to give a lot of his writers credit. And he actually relied on a lot of them. And so like a lot of the stuff that Hitchcock talks about is not always the absolute truth. So it's kind of interesting hearing all his stories because you're never quite sure.
Yeah, I've always heard like a lot of rumors and things that have happened on the sets. And I never know like what's true and what's not. It's really weird.
Yeah, when they said he let a pack of honey badgers out on the set one time on Psycho. Yeah.
he said I think this was from him too, like when he was doing an interview, he said that one time he had a dinner party after one of the sets, or maybe it was just a dinner party at his house, but he hired a cop to come in and like talk to someone and then go sit in the corner and just watch the dinner party happen. And he said, like, it was just a joke on everybody to have this cop, because he was always frightened of police.
Yeah.
So he said to have this cop come in, or maybe it was, like, somebody else called the cop to, like, play a trick on him or something like that, and it, like, it made him worried the whole time. But, like, that's the kind of pranks. Like, he would just do something, like, really just random, like, that kind of stuff. It wasn't always, like, I don't know, like, the, it's like a stupid kind of prank. It was always something, like, really random and, like, precise, and he would just set it up, and that was it. I don't know about the honey badger thing, but maybe that's part of it, too. Maybe he was a little bit more eccentric than I thought.
You think if YouTube existed back then, like, Hitchcock would be one of those guys, like, it's just a prank, bro.
He'd do Ashton Kutcher.
He'd be, yeah.
I think he,
you just got Hitchcocked.
He'd be siphoning, like, gas from, like, a black person's car. Just like, come on, get on, come on, man. Just a joke.
Just a prank, bro. Yeah. Just a prank, bro.
And apparently he bet some guy, like, a week's wages that he couldn't stay attached to a camera all night in a dark studio because the guy would be too afraid, and the guy's like, I'll do it. But I guess before that he gave him, like, a major laxative. And so he had the, he waited the whole night, but he was like crapping himself and had to like lay in his own stuff for the night.
Wow.
there's been nicer pranks.
Yeah,
there's a few, I guess.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's interesting. And, Hitchcock is a he's a bit eccentric, I think.
Is that the final answer to that question?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
A bit eccentric.
Okay.
So then,
But then to build off that real quick. I'm sorry, guys. He said, there's a quote when he was talking to Ebert. He said, in my opinion, the chief requisite for an actor is the ability to do nothing well, which is by no means as easy as it sounds. He should be willing to be utilized and wholly integrated into the picture by the director and the camera. He must allow the camera to determine the proper emphasis and the most effective dramatic highlights. So,
well, he used to refer to, wasn't it him who used to refer to like actors as cattle? He just said they were just props, basically.
And then later on, he said they should be treated like cattle. They're not cattle, which is kind of interesting.
I think Harrison Ford said the same thing about George Lucas. Like, he treats all the actors just like another prop.
Yeah, yeah.
Why can't you just say the line?
Just say the line. Move on to the next scene.
Sure.
And so that's the answer to the question.
There you go.
The second answer to the second question.
Yep.
All right, Mark. Well, if the audience wasn't paying attention before, I think they might have guessed what the topic of the day is. But for those few people who just, for some reason, decided to tune into the podcast like right about now, we'll let you break down what the topic is today, Mark.
Alfred Hitchcock. And, a lot of people are going to be like, who's that guy? A lot of people know who he is, but he's one of the greatest directors of all time. He's just the master of suspense, was born in 1899, died in 1980. But during his time, he started in 1925 and he started filming all the way through the 60s. So he had this incredibly long and prosperous career that saw, him mainly doing suspense thrillers, the occasional heist film, a lot of Wrong Man on the Run. And I guess the first movie we'll talk about real quick is The 39 Steps. So he did this movie in 35. And the guy who wrote Chinatown, the screenwriter, he said it's not much of an exaggeration to say that all contemporary escapist or entertainment begins with The 39 Steps. And like this was Britain's, they weren't big on the worldwide stage yet. They didn't have any big name actors. So this is one of their first. They've had some before, but this is one of their most expensive movies ever made. And they wanted it to break through to American audiences. So 39 Steps is basically about this tall, dashing man meeting a beautiful woman. She gets killed. They blame him. And he's on the run through the amazing Scottish Highlands. In the course, there's a guy with a missing finger. There's just a whole bunch of ups and downs and twists and turns. And it all leads to a pretty great ending with this guy called the Memory Man reciting these things. But, it's one of the – they said it was the fourth – let's see. The British Film Institute said it was the fourth best British film of the 20th century. Total Film loved it, one of my favorite magazines. It's – I know it was made in 35, but you watch it now and it still feels fresh.
Yeah, it's got a real, to me, like almost James Bond. Bondish type of feel. The fact that you have like this guy with like the finger, like that's his thing. You have like the whole spy, like the spies and the agents, and they're trying to uncover what was it, the secrets that that one guy was hiding that they didn't know?
The MacGuffin.
Yeah, that's like the whole, yeah, that's the whole thing. It's the MacGuffin. Like, what is it driving at it? But it actually is what led to, like, Hitchcock, like, when he did North by Northwest, there's a lot of tie-ins to that, too. Like, the whole, you know, ordinary man that's just caught up. Like, that's what Alfred Hitchcock liked. He liked doing a story about an ordinary person caught up in an extraordinary event. And that's what this was.
And it's kind of weird. I'm going to pat myself on the back, but I got the Criterion Blu-ray.
Nice.
And I just love it. Like, it's just I think these movies that he makes are so kind of timeless. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're definitely time capsules, but the theme is so universal. But you watch all these movies now, The Fugitive. A lot of these films, like I just mentioned one after I said all.
Yeah, a lot of films. Of
movies, yeah. The Fugitive.
I'll use my imagination.
It's just like... this movie is really important, and it definitely got America's attention. And 5 years later, he made the move over to America, where he made Rebecca, which is his only Best Picture winning film of his entire career.
Which is crazy. I think that's crazy that he only had one Best Picture winner of all the, like, you look at his filmography and like the classics he's done. It's crazy that only one of them ever won Best Picture.
And this one's more of like a gothic love story. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, the wrong man. It's not a theft. I mean, there is a murder in it, but it's off screen. But I guess Rebecca had Laurence Olivier and an amazing performance from Joan Fontaine. Mm-hmm. And I love her in Rebecca.
See, that's weird that you say that, because when I first saw Rebecca, and this was... I don't know, 6 years ago or something, 6 or 7 years ago, when I watched it, I actually didn't like her that much in the role. Now, I watched it again recently, and I like her a little bit more than I did. But at first, the first time I watched it, I felt like she was almost like overacting, and it kind of bothered me.
Interesting. See, she was really nervous.
Yeah.
Laurence Olivier didn't want her there. I believe he wanted Janet Leigh.
Vivian
Leigh. I can see that.
Yeah.
And then Hitchcock saw how uncomfortable she was. So then he started a rumor to her that the whole cast hated her and crew. So the whole time she was there, she was on like pins and needles.
He also spit in her face every time she got on set.
Yeah, and he gave her a kidney shot before each take.
Roll camera.
Pop. But what I find interesting is this started one of his major traits, which was he would film no extra footage. So North by Northwest, we'll get to that later. Mm. He only filmed 8 feet of extra footage, which means the studios had nothing to play with. And so he had started started working with this prolific American producer, Selznick. And Selznick was like, you know, directors are my puppets. I have final cut. And he and Hitchcock fought. And what Hitchcock would do is he would film no extra footage. So Selznick's like, crap, I have to use what he gives me because there's nothing else to cut. Like, if they cut something, other things wouldn't make sense.
Right.
But there's nothing to add.
That's interesting.
Tricky Hitchcock.
Yeah. He's a master. He's a master of his domain.
And a lot of people say this is from, like, his storyboarding. So he obsessively storyboarded. So he knew in his head when the script was done, he knew exactly what he wanted. So, like, John Ford, when he was filming, like, he did the same thing. He would throw his hat in front of the camera after, like, right after they cut. And that way the editor couldn't play with anything that they had. So he learned, because the studios were so powerful back then. It was had to sign like a studio contract. They owned you. And Hitchcock really fought that with his films. So I don't know. It's kind of cool. Like Rebecca used like great there's cool sets that they had. It was one of the first things to use like deep focus photography. The woman who played Danvers, I believe it was.
Danvers,
Mrs.
Yeah.
Danvers.
Yep.
He always had it. He never showed her walking. It always seemed like she was floating. So he really knew what he was doing in this movie.
And this movie came in, like, what, 2 hours? A little over 2 hours?
Yeah.
That's one thing, I guess, when you mentioned that was one thing I was going to bring up in this podcast, is that it feels like in most of Hitchcock's movies, there's a pretty abrupt ending, like, in the sense that it's, like, I guess what you're saying is there really is no, like, extra footage. So it's just, like, it's going from one scene to the next. and it's got everything that needs to be in the film to continue the story and have it go all the way to the end. And the ending always kind of ends abruptly for me, like especially like in Rebecca, like spoiler alert, like the whole fire thing, like kind of just abruptly happens, and that's just how it ends. And like that's, I thought like that was a very abrupt ending. Same with like North by Northwest, how it's just. It's just him on the train with her. That's it. Like right after the big climactic chase. But that makes sense. I guess that makes sense. He doesn't want to dwell on anything that like too much after the story's done.
You know what I do love though about North by Northwest? At the very last shot was meant to be funny, because Hitchcock liked messing with the Hays Code, which was like a very strict code in Hollywood. You couldn't kiss for longer than 3 seconds, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But the final shot of North by Northwest is Cary Grant kissing Eva Marie Saint in a train. The next shot is a train going through a tunnel.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's awesome.
So like it's just like it ends on like a sex metaphor to get away from the Hays Code.
Well, that's interesting. Is with
Notorious?
Notorious.
Yeah.
Not because we were talking about Rebecca, but like there is like a lot of sexual undertones with a lot of his movies. In Rebecca, it's, you know, Rebecca, who you never meet. She's just this
the ex-wife?
Yeah, the ex-wife of Laurence Olivier, where she's dead, but you find out about her in the sense that she apparently maybe had a kid with like this other guy because she was cheating on her husband. And then in Notorious, which we're going to talk about a little bit, is like they kind of make all these allusions to Ingrid Bergman being like almost a whore. Like they're just like, she's this kind of woman. Like, do you think she could marry this guy and get him to fall in love with her real fast? Like, yeah, she's really good at that. Like, she can do that. She makes men fall in love with her easily. And like, there's like a lot of allusions to her just being like almost like kind of like this easy seductress kind of person.
No, yeah, for sure. And that was like kind of the complete opposite of Joan Fontaine's character in Rebecca.
Yeah, she was all safe and nerdy. Not nerdy, but like safe and like just very on edge and very like just, you know, like she's. But it's weird because like halfway through when she finds out about the death and how Rebecca died, she kind of just loses her innocent girl image and just turns into this other person.
Yeah, she sort of becomes a gangster. Like she never has her own name either.
That's true. She's just Mrs. Danvers.
Yeah,
or not like, Danvers, Mrs. DeWitt.
Yeah, and like so that's her name in the whole movie.
DeWitt.
And
the second one.
I just loved how, like, I guess I knew that fact about her before I watched Rebecca. So just watching how nervous she was during the entire shoot.
Yeah, that's why, like, when I first watched, I always felt like she was overacting. I liked Laurence Olivier in it, but it's Laurence Olivier. But then, like, watching her, it kind of felt like almost like it's just, like, too much, like, the opposite. And, like, her nervous nature, like, the way her facial expressions, the way she was, like, just moving about like so much, like her shoulders were just like moving, like her shoulders and her eyebrows just constantly. But then like I kind of noticed that,
like,
it wasn't
like moving around like Vanilla Ice from Ice Baby.
Yeah, pretty much. Like... yeah, she even sings a bit of that in Rebecca. A lot of people don't know, not only did Vanilla Ice steal that sound from Under Pressure,
yeah,
but he also took some of the dance moves from Joan Fontaine in Rebecca.
I had no idea he was a cinephile. Vanilla Ice. He's resourceful.
One crazy cat.
I call this a Joan Fontaine. And everyone's like, what?
Yeah, who?
What?
No, but I think Rebecca, watching it, because I just watched it today again, and like watching it again, like I did like it. I did appreciate a lot of what it had to offer. And it wasn't, I remember watching it back in the day and thinking it was like almost too slow. And now I don't really think so. Like I said before, there's just like these long scenes of exposition or monologues telling you like what happened, because you never meet Rebecca. You just hear from all these characters of who she was. And it kind of unravels more and more as the story goes on, and it gets like deeper. And I like that about it.
Yeah, no, and yeah, it's on YouTube actually. So
that's where I watched it.
Yeah, that's where I watched it, because I tried to find it, but it's really not available anywhere. So I just
is it in the public domain?
Well, 35. How old does it have to be in the public domain?
About 75 years, right?
Yeah, then it must be. Because it came out in...
1940.
Yeah.
It won Best Picture in 1940.
Huh. So that's just there.
Just made it.
That's right. Yeah, but that's crazy, though. This is his only Best Picture. And he didn't even win for Best Director. John Ford won for The Grapes of Wrath. So
yeah, he never won for Best Director. Anything. No. He got an honorary Oscar like in the 70s or something, right?
Well, that's like a participation award.
Yeah, that's like, good job. You did do movies.
It's like, hey, we messed up.
Yeah. We definitely, because the same thing happened with Cary Grant. He never won an Oscar. He got an honorary Oscar in the 80s. That was just because they're like, ah, shit. Yeah.
Thanks, Scott.
Hey, you know all those like amazing movies you're in that are now considered classics? Like, are bad.
Yeah, I know. That's why I never understood. Like, I watch the Academy Awards all the time, but it's like, it's crazy. Like, people always give shit to the Academy Awards when it comes to like Leo. Leo hasn't won an Oscar. I'm like, Cary Grant never won an Oscar. Like, I know a lot of people don't know who Cary Grant is because he's an older actor, but like, he never won an Oscar. Alfred Hitchcock never won a Best Directing Oscar. I mean, you look at all his movies: Spellbound, Vertigo, The Birds, Psycho, Notorious, Rear Window. I mean, it's just like nothing.
Man, yeah. There's like a vein just kind of bulging on your forehead.
Oh, I'm so angry right now.
Yeah, the BBC in 2015, they got all these. I think I'd already said this, but I think four of his movies were in the top 15 of like the greatest American movies ever made, according to like hundreds of critics. Like, this guy made long lasting art.
Yeah, I mean, they're gonna always be considered classics, and there's a lot. I mean. So many movies.
Right. But I don't think it bothers me. I understand it, but that's kind of why we wanted to do this podcast, was because, like, these movies hold up.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they aren't, like, but I also think the problem with these films are you sort of have to turn off the lights. You know, if you've watched them already, that's fine. But some of these films, you just got to let it, you got to, like, absorb them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Because a lot of them don't hit you till the final shot. They build to the final thing, and there's a lot of information you can miss. And I feel like you're cheating yourself if you're on your phone. But I get that people are busy and have lives. But it takes a lot more. Do you think so? It takes a lot more you just got to watch it.
Well, what's great is that if you don't like one of his movies, granted, most of his movies are suspenseful type movies. But he does have, like, there are other aspects to them. Like, North by Northwest is more, to me, like, action-y. It's a suspenseful movie, but there's mystery to it. There's action to it. There's even comedy to it.
Yeah, funny.
Yeah, but, like, The Birds is more horror, so is Psycho. Those are, like, and a lot of people think he's, like, a horror director, but he's not. He's only done those two horror movies, The Birds and Psycho. Everything else. But you can watch movies like Shadow of a Doubt with Joseph Cotten. That's, like, a good just mystery, suspenseful film. And it's a lot different than something like Dial M for Murder or The Birds or even like, what was the other one I just mentioned? Like Spellbound. Like, there's just a lot of like his movies, like they do have a lot of suspense, but like you can find something different. And like some people I know love some of his movies and don't love others. Like Jonathan, who does a lot of the podcast with us, doesn't really like Rebecca. He didn't like Rebecca at all, but he loves Dial M for Murder and he loves some of the other movies that Alfred Hitchcock has done. So I think you just have to like kind of try to sift through them, especially like a lot of the ones that are considered classics, and look at those.
And this is gonna be crazy to me because Vertigo and The Birds, I like them, but they're not my favorite.
Right, same here.
I think my we'll get into them, but one of my top three is the one you love, Notorious.
Oh, I love that movie. Love it.
And it's just so good. Ingrid Bergman, who is the best. Mm. And then
Cary Grant.
Yeah, Cary Grant. And that got made in 1946, which was kind of the perfect time to come out because, you know, Nazis.
Right. Cary Grant's one of my favorite actors. And he's, again, you know, Cary Grant is just playing Cary Grant in most of his movies. But he's just good at playing Cary Grant. So I like him, and he stars in a lot of good movies. And, like, Notorious, like, it's – I remember Roger Ebert. The reason why I watched it was Roger Ebert listed his top 5 or top 10 movies of all time, and Notorious was on there. And I thought it was really weird saying Notorious and not another Alfred Hitchcock movie like Vertigo or Psycho, like one of his more mainstream ones. So I was like, let me check out Notorious, and I ended up falling in love with it. Like, literally, I want to marry it.
So it tells the story of – what a spy, right? Cary Grant, he recruits the I guess they find a guy that's a mole for the Nazis. Mm-hmm. He kills himself. They recruit that guy's wife, played by Ingrid Bergman, the kind of party girl wife, to be a spy in Brazil. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, her and Grant end up falling in love. But then her task is to marry this little German spy in Brazil and find out what they're trying to do. Claude Rains, who she was in Casablanca with, too. Yep. But then Cary Grant is so angry about it. He's like, well, I love her. Now she has to go sleep. He's like, now she has to go sleep with some other guy. Then he becomes an absolute brat. And she like puts her life on the line.
And there's that reference where like he like she actually like does kind of mention that she's now sleeping with Claude Rains' character, and Cary Grant just like you see him just get so angry. But he's like making her do it. Like that's his job. His intel is like her.
Yeah, and he signed her up for it and then fell in love with her and then became a brat.
Yeah.
And then she's just so good in it. And I guess Hitchcock was obsessed with her.
Really?
Yeah. And
Notorious, what's great about that, or like what I like about it, John's looking up Notorious B.I.G. not the same thing.
It was a movie. It came out in 2009.
Yeah, not that Notorious. But what's great is there's a lot of suspense to this movie, and none of it's like really like murderous. It's not like his other movies. It's like the wine bottles. Like they're trying to look at wine bottles in the cellar, and they got to hurry up before the wine bottles at the dinner party or whatever upstairs, before, you know, they run out of wine and they have to go to the cellar to get more wine. So they're like, you're watching this ice bucket of wine bottles disappearing while Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman are downstairs sifting through to try to find like secrets. And it's like really nerve wracking, but yeah, it's really simple.
Stop drinking, you bastards.
I know, right? They're just drinking too much champagne and wine.
And like the final shot, like death really isn't in the cards for, so they end up, they find out that Bergman, you know, has been spying, and they start slowly poisoning her. Mm-hmm. And then Cary Grant comes back and gets her.
Yeah.
And at the end, like, no one's going to really kill them. Well, it's just like, well, Claude Rains is going to get it.
But, you know, that's – I remember I was talking to my dad about this, and my dad brought up this fact about Notorious was – he said it's kind of interesting because you almost feel bad for the bad guy at the end.
Yeah, because, he loved her.
Yeah, Claude Rains really loved Ingrid Bergman, but she was just a spy. And then he finds out that he married an agent, so him and his mom start poisoning her. And then – at the end, when you said like Cary Grant shows up and he's trying to take Ingrid Bergman out of there because he finds out she's sick, and they're going down the stairs, and it's very nerve wracking because all those other Nazi guys are there, and they're all like kind of going, "What's going on?" And Claude Rains is trying to keep his cool, and they're trying to bring him to the bring her to the hospital. And as they're walking towards the car, he just wants to get in the car too, so it makes it look like he's caring for her. And Cary Grant just leaves him there, like leaves the bad guy Claude Rains out there. And he has to kind of just sulkily walk up the steps back to the house where these guys, these German officers or whatever, know that he's lying about something. And then you figure out he's going to die. Like, they're going to kill him like they did that other guy.
Yeah, it's – but, it, like, you know, it's you end up feeling for a German mama's boy spy.
You know, and it's funny you say mama's boy because is it me or does, like, Alfred Hitchcock have a weird thing with moms? There's a lot of just moms in all his movies, and they're always like either overbearing or like murderous or something, like just something weird.
Like in North by Northwest, so they're more buddies though.
They're like more buddies in that, yeah. But Psycho, obviously, Notorious, like he lived with his mother.
Yeah.
John's looking up a picture of the Notorious B.I.G. with his mother.
But you know what's kind of neat? So if you guys please watch Notorious, you'll love it. And there's a shot where there's a very famous shot. There's two I kind of want to talk about. There's one where there's this coffee cup, and then in the back, like it's a kind of a neat little focus shot that they pulled. But instead of using a little coffee cup, they use a big one. So it looks like a regular coffee cup, and then in the background, there's Ingrid Bergman. So it's like this great depth of field shot.
Oh, nice.
And then also the Hays Code, you couldn't kiss somebody for more than 3 seconds. Like if you did that, the scene should be over. Mm-hmm. So there's this scene where Grant and Bergman walk around this hotel room smooching, but only for 2 seconds. So they kiss for 2 seconds, walk somewhere, talk, you know, kiss for 2 seconds, walk somewhere, talk, kiss for 2 seconds, walk somewhere, talk. So it's one of the longest kissing scenes ever, but they only could kiss for 2 seconds at a time and then stop.
That's interesting.
Like they couldn't break 3 seconds. So when you watch it, they're smooching all over the house. That sounds like Home Alone 2. You've been smooching everybody.
Yeah.
So let's once again, Hitchcock messing with the Hays Code.
Yeah,
they were just kissing for 2 seconds.
Oh, he always pushed the limits. And like, I mean, if you like we said with Rebecca, you can watch Notorious. It's on YouTube also. Like, I have it on Blu-ray, but I saw it on YouTube along with Rebecca and then a couple other Hitchcock films, like older ones.
Man, because there's so many talk. We always find things like we did the Bond podcast in an hour.
I know, right?
Like we gotta start talking about like one movie at a time.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Let's just take a quick break then. You know,
ooh. Take a quick break. Come right back.
I'm gonna keep looking up pictures of the Taurus B.I.G.
Of course. Thanks for your input, John.
Robert.
Mm-hmm.
John.
Yes.
Complete the sequence.
Mm-hmm.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. What are we doing?
Counting.
Counting what?
Down.
Counting down what? Everything?
Everything and anything.
Anything and everything?
That's right. The three of us, we count down from 5 down to 1. Top 5, everything and anything that you can think of. You want to know the top 5 shittiest bands? You want to know the top 5 movies? Listen, Shark Dropper Studios, sharkdropper.com.
Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. And that Notorious movie is pretty good.
Yeah, you liked it?
Yeah. Yeah.
John sat over here and just watched it so he can kind of jump in on the conversation. What did you think about the Notorious B.I.G.?
I think it gave like some pretty good insight into into the rapper.
Were you shocked that Hitchcock directed that 2009 feature? You know, because he was dead 30 years before?
I mean, I guess.
Okay.
I wasn't honestly, what shocked me the most is that Anthony Mackie, mm-hmm. who plays Falcon in the Captain America movies, he plays Tupac in that movie.
Does he really?
Yeah, yeah. I don't
know. Why had your headphones on? Robert read me a short story backwards and upside down.
True.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm still learning about this reading thing.
I didn't correct him because it was so impassioned.
Yeah. It was good, though, right?
Yeah, was it Bjorn Borg?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bjorn Borg.
It's about how Jorn Borg bores doors, bore door, but then he goes back to the floor door, hey, bore. Then he meets a rah, rah, rah.
Have you read it?
Well, I just took good notes.
Okay. Sure.
Hey,
Spark notes.
Speaking of tongue twisters,
yes.
I think it's time to answer another list of questions.
Oh.
Yeah.
All right. So can I Sparks note his question?
Please.
Oh, gosh. Okay, this one's from Chris. Why did Hitchcock never direct a comedy?
Didn't he?
No, so he had Hitchcock had a wicked sense of humor and he was a prankster. Why did he never dabble in directing straight up comedy? So this is what I'm thinking. He loved to have control of – now, there were humorous elements in his films. But I think with thrillers and Wrong Man and Wrong Man movies, you know, action films and these horror films he made, the way he made them and cut them and shot them were so specific. Like Memento, or you know, I keep saying all these movies, and I just say one.
You give one example every time. It's all right. We know what you're saying.
Yeah,
there's right, more.
I gotta stop saying all these movies. So,
just say like that, Memento.
Yeah, like Memento. That allowed him a lot of control.
Right, but didn't he direct a comedy? He directed one comedy.
He directed a comedy.
Yeah.
What was the name of the movie?
Topaz.
Robert?
Mr. and Mrs. Smith. Wasn't that him? Look it up.
With Brad Pitt.
And Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie.
Oh, I don't think he did that.
That one. The original.
He had Frenzy, Psycho, Vertigo, Wrong Man, Man Who Knew Too Much.
I could be
Strangers
wrong.
Strangers on a Train.
But look up Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
You're thinking Doug Liman.
Maybe. I don't even see it. It's not even pulling up on Rotten Tomatoes. Hold on. There is. That's not it. That's Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Yeah, that was.
That's Frank Capra.
Yeah, Capra. Yeah. No, but I mean, like,
hold on, I'm gonna look it up.
In North by Northwest, there's that scene where, like, they made me chug whiskey, and his mom's like, "Did you get a chaser?" He's like, "No, Ma, no chaser."
Oh yeah.
There's humor, but I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, guys. I don't think that he directed any straight up comedies.
Hold on, I gotta IMDb this.
Like, there's no Down Periscope on his resume.
There should be.
Wish he directed that Kelsey Grammer classic.
Maybe it was just outside of his comfort zone. Like, even though he had like a sense of humor and it showed sparingly in some of his movies, like maybe it just wasn't something he felt like he needed to tackle.
Will you go to IMDb? I just want to see if it's on there. It's not pulling up on here. There is an old movie called Mr. and Mrs. Smith that I swear he directed.
Hey, you're really desperate about this.
I really want to see if I'm wrong.
Did you read it backwards?
Yeah. It was Hith. I'm not even going to try to do it. I'm done. Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
I mean, I just, like you said, that was in his wheelhouse. He had a fascination with death. He had a fascination with you know, mothers and keys and that kind of aspect. And I also think he had a lot of control because he could make them the way he wanted because all the chips had to fall in place.
Found it. Yes. Mr. and Mrs. Smith has Carol Lombard and Robert Montgomery in it, and it's directed by Alfred Hitchcock. It was the only one he ever did. And I don't think he even wanted to do it. I think it was under contract or something that he had to do it. It's comedy romance.
But it's not on his IMDb.
Rom-com?
It's not.
Alfred Hitchcock.
Oh, yeah, it is. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
1941.
Holy
1941,
crap. Yeah. It's not a typical Hitchcock movie. This is a comedy about a couple who learned that their marriage was not valid.
Son of a bitch.
Yeah. Wow. I watched it, and I'll tell you this, it's not good. It's not
there were
good
people
movie.
Probably slamming their, like, well, there's probably like a couple of people slamming their desks at work. Mr. and Mrs. Smith!
No, because I remember it. I remember that I watched the whole movie, and I will admit that there was one part that I laughed at, but it was an overall comedy, and I didn't laugh that much. But it was like, it's kind of like a weaker film. But I don't remember why he directed it, and I don't think he wanted to direct it, and he was kind of, like, talked into it or forced to or something. It was an okay movie, but I remember when Mr. and Mrs. Smith came out, the Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie one, everybody thought it was a remake, but it's really not. It's not a remake of the old one.
So the answer to this question is, actually, he did.
He did. Yeah. The answer is yes.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. So...
yeah, but I
wait. Let's see. Alfred Hitchcock decided to direct this film because of Carol Lombard's request. This is one of the few films where Hitchcock wasn't involved in the scripting process, since he really didn't understand the type of people who were portrayed in the film. All he did basically was photograph the scenes as written. This is the first Alfred Hitchcock film to be shown on American network television.
Oh shit. Why would they pick that one? That's weird.
It's a rom-com.
Well, it's an early one, too.
She basically, he said it was just a favor.
Man.
Yeah.
That's like asking, like, today, like, M. Night Shyamalan to make, like, a romantic comedy. Did he make one?
You know what, John? Let's IMDb it.
honestly, while you IMDb that, we'll let Mark pick back up with the topic.
So, while you're searching through everything with your binoculars, we're going to be talking about Rear Window, which might be my favorite Hitchcock film.
Is it?
Yeah.
It's one of my favorites, yeah.
I love – so Hitchcock tells a story of a photographer, a real jerk, played by Jimmy Stewart. He's holed up in his apartment. He has a broken leg. You don't know from what. And he just starts taking spying on his neighbors because, you know, it's the 50s.
Yeah, and they don't really have, like, TV. I mean, they have TV, but not much on.
I mean, there's not. Yeah, so he's just kind of spying on his neighbors in a beautiful set built by Hitchcock. And his girlfriend is Grace Kelly, fiance. She, like, loves the living daylights out of him, but he doesn't think she – like, I think he feels she's too good for him and doesn't think that she would like life on the road as, like, a carny because he's a photographer.
Right.
I've actually met a lot of jerk photographers. Like on my film set days, I'm not going to name them, but I kind of understood his character.
Right.
And I mean, like Grace Kelly's in it. She's amazing. And he witnesses a murder, not witnesses, but he sees clues. And the rest of the film is just him in his apartment trying to piece together a murder.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Grace Kelly and his, nurse, that comes over and takes care of him.
Thelma Ritter.
Yeah, Thelma Ritter.
Is that John Ritter's mom? I don't think it is. Never mind.
I'm gonna say yes.
I'm gonna look it up. I'll IMDb it. You keep talking.
And so, but what I love about it is, it's just, I love his performance, and I love the suspense, and I love how he's able to build the suspense just by a few clues that he has. And I love that he's kind of helpless. Like, you know, Grace Kelly does most of the work in this film.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, she goes over. He's unable to help her.
Yeah, that's actually, like, really suspenseful is when he's watching her. And you're just watching her from the window that he's watching out of. And it's, like, pretty suspenseful.
Yeah, and like, it's just, I don't know, I love it. I think it adds, I think there's some levity to it. I think there's some humor. I don't, listen, it's not his best. So I'm not saying this is his best movie, but I think it's my favorite.
It's definitely, for me, it's in my top five Hitchcock films. It's definitely, might even be my top three. I really do like Rear Window. It's got, to me, there's like certain movies that like I can fall asleep to because I always put them on because they're just very like, they're very homey. Like they're just, they all take place in like one area. Like Night of the Living Dead's one of them. The Shining's another one for me. But Rear Window's also one too, where it's just like, it all takes place in one area. And it's like interesting that you can get like this much out of it. Same with like Rope, where it's all taking place in one room and you can like derive a whole story from that. And that's pretty much what he does. And you're kind of watching all these characters with him, and you're trying to try to piece it together. Like, is he crazy? Is it going to turn out that this guy isn't a murderer? Like, you don't know. But it's still, like, really suspenseful when he sends Grace Kelly over there. And then the fact that, like, no one really believes him. Yeah, it's an interesting film, and it's one of my favorites, too.
I like what Ebert said. He's like, there are crucial moments in the film where he is clearly required to act. And he delays not because he doesn't care what happens, but because he forgets he can be an active player. He is absorbed in a passive role. Significantly, at the end, when he is in danger in his own apartment, his weapon is his camera's flash gun. He hopes to blind or dazzle his enemy as the man's eyesight gradually returns. It is through a blood-red resolve that suggests passion expressed through the eyes. And yeah. I don't know. I think Hitchcock had all this planned out, and I love it. The guy came to his house, and then like I feel like the ending was never in doubt. Mm. But I don't know. Just I don't know. I think Grace Kelly is like my favorite.
She's great. She was great in Dial M for Murder. Also,
I was gonna say she's my favorite Bond woman.
she's my favorite
Hitchcock.
Almost Bond girl. She could have been a Bond girl.
Yeah, and like he wanted her for other roles, but she retired to become a princess. Mm-hmm. But
as you do, as most actresses do.
Yeah. But like, I don't know. I don't know.
Is that what happened to John Heder?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, retired to become a princess.
Yeah, he's a princess right now.
Oh yeah, okay.
Living in his castle.
Good for him.
All princesses live in a castle.
Yeah,
guys. The one good thing is Rear Window's always on cable.
Yeah.
So just go schedule it on your DVR and watch it. It's really worth it. It's a good performance. You know, I met some people that complained about the way he treated Grace Kelly in the film. But I just think he's a jerky photographer.
Yeah, I don't think he
takes her for granted.
Yeah. But do you think he's like taking her for granted, or he's just like he knows that he's kind of lucky having her, and he's just kind of like I don't know. I don't know. It's like
incredibly
weird,
lucky.
Yeah. Because is he supposed to be – Jimmy Stewart looks older than her by a lot. He's like – I don't know how old he is in that film. But she can't – she's got to be what? In her 20s? Late 20s?
Yeah.
Maybe?
Yeah.
And he's got to be in his 40s?
Yep.
I don't know.
Yeah, and you're right, though. I do think there's these moments where he does feel really insecure, and that leads to a lot of bluster. Like, I guess like I said – sometimes a lot of Hitchcock films, the men are like, you think that they're like very full of bravado, but I think it's a lot of insecurity.
Yeah, I can see that. It's just the way they come off. Like, I can understand why people would think that Jimmy Stewart, the way he treated Grace Kelly, like you can kind of see it's a little bit like on the jerkish side. But like you're saying, it's not. It's probably just insecurity because he does realize like how good he has it with her.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. It is the 50s.
That's true too. You know, he'll probably smack her ass like Sean Connery in Dr. No or Goldfinger and just send her on her way. He's and then ask her to make a sandwich later. Right. Yeah.
Did anybody watch you guys have watched the remake that came out.
Of what? Rear Window?
Yeah.
Oh, you're talking about Disturbia?
Yeah.
Shia LaBeouf. I didn't really hate it that much. I thought it was all right.
I enjoyed it, actually. It was fun. Not as good as Rear Window.
Right.
But... I think I watched it with you, Lazareth.
You know, you probably did. We were probably drinking.
When did that come out? 07 or something?
Yeah.
Yeah. If it was around then we watched it together.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure we did.
I forgot. That was a remake. Yeah. Rear Window, basically.
Well, no, they tried to sue because I just wrote that big post about remakes. And I think I was like, is it a remake? Is it not? And they tried to sue them over it. But then they're like, well, it's not. They couldn't get any money out of them for it. Like, well, it's not or technically a remake.
But it was
but
a remake.
But isn't it? It is a remake.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Like, the judge was like, I hate doing this, but it's not a remake.
That's interesting. It is.
Yeah, it's a remake.
It's a remake of it's the exact same story, except it takes place with our kids.
No, don't you understand? It's Shia LaBeouf.
Yeah, it's not Jimmy Stewart.
He's the hot new thing, man.
It's not a remake. It's not Jimmy Stewart. Yeah. That's it. It's not a remake.
Hitchcock did.
Yeah, Hitchcock's dead. Who cares?
Guys, he's in a house. They were in apartments.
That's true.
Yeah.
He's not a photographer.
He's a kid.
he's loaded on Red Bull.
And eating peanut butter and chocolate. I remember he did that in the movie.
And he has his mom there.
Yeah, his mom, Trinity from Matrix.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
Whenever I see her in movies now and she's acting like she's kind of weak, I'm like, what's going on here? Like, I always expect her just to spin kick a dude into oblivion.
Yeah, where's your trench coat and your submachine guns?
Where's the latex?
She left it at home.
Yeah, I remember that in Red Planet. Why is she on the space station and not kicking ass? Why kicking robot ass on Mars?
She should just be breathing Mars air.
Yeah. Anyways, back to Hitchcock.
Speaking of breathing bad air, mm-hmm. North by Northwest.
Ooh, that's the next one we're going to talk about.
I guess that makes sense because of the crop duster.
Yeah. That was a good segue. Not good, but it worked.
Like, if I was in class right now, the instructor would give me like a
C plus.
Yeah, well, I think B minus.
B minus. That's
because I did kind of attach, like, I did lead a segue from Disturbia to, or no, I led one from what?
You led one from Red Planet to North by Northwest.
I mean, he would respect me on those ends. But he's like, you're not going to get away with that often enough.
That's true. Well, I don't think anytime you're comparing Red Planet to something else or trying to link it to something else, I don't know if that's even like you can even get an A at that point.
But that's like a deep cut.
That is. That's a really deep cut. Red Planet starring Val Kilmer and North by Northwest starring Cary Grant.
Like, I think, and if I threw in Last Days of Mars on there.
Yeah.
You know, I threw in Life Aquatic because Sue George covers, you know,
there you
Life
go.
On Mars in Portuguese.
In Portuguese.
I'm leaving out The Martian because it's too easy.
So you're not going to say anything about potatoes?
I think I've talked myself to a B.
And I think more a C minus.
Put much
now.
Effort into it.
At this point, C minus.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say about North by Northwest is this is my favorite Hitchcock film.
You know, that whole segment was basically just a really long segue.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Pretty much.
So then do I get points for that?
No.
No.
Yeah. Oh. Negative points, actually.
C minus.
Yeah.
All right, so this is 59.
59.
And, yeah. And this is basically the 39 steps, but with more.
More stuff. More chases, more suspense, more Cary Grant, more tanned Cary Grant.
Hanging out with his mother.
Hanging out with mom. More moms. More. Who is it? Eva Marie Saint. Actually, I like the cast. It's got Cary Grant, Eva Marie Saint, and James Mason as the bad guy. And James Mason plays a good bad guy. Or God. Was he God? He was God in that one movie, Heaven Can Wait. Think he was God. So he plays a good bad guy and a good God.
And also Martin Landau was a really different kind of character. He was like like a lot of people didn't complain about his character. They thought he was like too effeminate.
Really?
Yeah. Well, because remember that scene, he's like, call it my womanly intuition. And like the guy's like, you're jealous. Yeah. Like a lot of people in 59 were like, I don't like it.
Yeah, this is too much. If there's any kissing over 3 seconds, I'm out of here.
I don't like Martin Landau.
No, this one, not only is it my favorite Hitchcock movie, it's one of my favorite movies of all time. Like, it's in my top five.
Really?
And, yeah, I love North by Northwest. I've seen it, I don't know how many times. Got it on Blu-ray, got that little book Blu-ray because I love the book with the pages inside it that tells you about the movie. And
I have a Citizen Kane one of those.
Yeah, I have that too, the Citizen Kane one.
Dude, I love the book Blu-rays.
I wish that every movie had a book Blu-ray.
Yeah, you know, really? I bought a Princess
every movie.
Every, well, every not movie. Everyone.
Like
Saw 4 doesn't need one.
I gotta know about them gags, man. I gotta know about them
torture
blood
devices.
Geysers.
Yeah.
But so tell us, like, why is it one of your top five?
I think, to me, North by Northwest, when I think of, like, cinema and, like, just like, going to the movies, like, the movie-going experience, I think North by Northwest is one of those movies that, to me, has a little bit of everything. And I know we talked about this a little bit with, like, his other movies, but it really does have some comedy aspects to it that actually, like, make me laugh. There's actually a lot of action. There's a lot of suspense. There's romance. I mean, there's just a little bit of, like, everything put together. And I think it's, like, put together perfectly. Like, nothing's, like, too much. Nothing's outdoing the other thing. And it's just,
sweet,
like,
a little sour, little salty,
some
spicy.
Some
savory.
Yep, sweet and spicy, man. This is like the Chex Mix, the best Chex Mix you can get.
Yeah.
It's that sweet and salty caramel crunch.
It's every part of your tongue at the same time.
Yeah, I'm not sharing my bowl of North by Northwest, okay? North by Northwest is all mine.
Okay. You can have it. Yeah.
No, I also, Cary Grant's one of my favorite actors. I do like James Mason as the bad guy. He's just cool and collected the whole time. Eva Marie Saint, I remember watching her in On the Waterfront, I think, which was her breakout role. She's really good in that. And then I think she's even better in this. Like, she's just really good. And she's like the girl that seduces Cary Grant at first, but then ends up falling in love with him and stuff. And it's like,
of course.
I mean, that's just how it's going to go. But I think, like, to me, this is, like, one of those movies that's, like, it's, like, almost a perfect movie because of that kind of stuff. There are some things that are outdated, like some of the CGI effects. But, like, you got to think, like, back then, that whole Mount Rushmore chase sequence fight on top of it, it's, like, it's really intense.
And that scene with the crop duster, it was just him in front of a green, like, a screen.
Right. But it looks, like, it looks decent.
Yeah, I mean, this is 59.
Yeah,
like that, it's not like you know there were great techniques. So, you know, Bridge on the River Kwai was out, et cetera, et cetera. But this was like a really ambitious, and actually in 39 Steps there's a plane scene too,
the helicopter, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
And then there's this, like the cropped up. But I don't know. I love the introduction of Cary Grant. Like, he's just sort of like this twice married playboy. Divorced playboy who, like, is a mama's boy.
But he's a businessman, and he just gets caught up in shit.
Yeah, and he keeps making wrong moves. And there's that scene where he goes to the – there's a place where they're doing some bidding on some items.
And
he just makes,
like,
a total scene.
Because he wants to get out of there because the bad guys are going to block his exit.
Yeah.
So he wants to get escorted out by police. So he just causes this big ruckus, causes a fight. And
he punches a cop.
Yeah. Oh, man, that shit was great.
Yeah, like this.
There's a lot to this movie that I think, like, it's just I don't know. To me, it's really, I think on AFI, I want to say it was number 59 or 58 on their 100 greatest movies of all time list. Mm-hmm. I think
what?
Yeah, I think it was pretty, like, low on their 100 greatest. But
you know, I never liked their music anyway.
AFI, I know.
Yeah.
Miss Murder, come on.
Hey,
Miss Murder.
Like, I care what you think.
What? Because I'm trying to think. Psycho, Vertigo, Rear Window, North by Northwest, all made it on AFI's 100 Greatest Movies.
On the BBC one, they had Marnie, they had Psycho, Vertigo, North by Northwest, Notorious, a few others.
Nice.
Yeah, there were six. No, but I don't know. This is fun. It's just a good, you know, wrong man movie.
But I think it's Spalling. Like, yeah, I think it's more action packed than like his other movies. So maybe if like people don't take to his other films that are a little bit more slow moving, like Notorious or Rebecca, they might like North by Northwest.
No, absolutely. I love it. I've probably watched it like four times, and every time I do, I keep finding more things I like about it.
Yeah, and like I remember you saying how Alfred Hitchcock never left a lot to be edited out, and like you kind of feel this that way with this movie too. Like everything that's in it, although like some of the scenes do take their time, like building the suspense, like the crop duster scene. I remember taking a film course at school, and like they like storyboarded the whole scene with. That the crop duster scene, like with Cary Grant standing out there, and like you look at like the storyboards for all of it, and it's just crazy, like how much work went into it, and like how it really builds up the tension, and I love that about it.
And there's a rumor that Hitchcock picked out all of Eva Marie Saint's clothes.
Did he?
Yeah, which I thought was interesting. And then Cary Grant thought it was going to flop.
Really?
Yeah, he's like, this is not going to do well.
That's interesting. That's like one of his best movies.
Yeah, exactly.
that's well, crazy.
On the set of No Country for Old Men, one of the Coen brothers looked at Josh Brolin, and he's like, this is going to bomb.
I mean, I guess sometimes you can't. There's movies where people think it's going to be great, and it just fucking...
Gods of Egypt!
Oh, woo-hoo! How do you even think of that shit? It's like going to be like great. There's no
Paycheck.
Way.
Paycheck!
What was the other one? Not Gods of Egypt.
Waterworld.
No, the one with the one.
You know, Costner was gung ho about that one the whole way.
Gosh. Yeah. Then he did Postman. He's like, what the fuck's going on? I do Dances with Wolves. I've done Dancing with Wolves, guys. Come on.
Okay.
The best wrestling match ever in a movie is the Postman.
No, what was that really, Scott? Not Gods of Egypt.
Gods and Generals.
No, that was the Civil War.
That was the sequel to Gettysburg.
That was the Civil War one, yeah. No, what? I gotta look it up. I'll IMDb it. You guys keep talking.
What is this?
The Ridley Scott directed, it had Russell Crowe in it.
Exodus,
Gods and Kings.
I was about to say
if you
Alien.
Said Kingdom of Heaven, I was gonna jump through there and just scream director's cut.
No way. No way.
Guys, Kingdom of Heaven director's cut.
It's that good?
You know, I'm thinking that between the Lord of the Rings movies, Hobbit, Kingdom of Heaven, and the Pirates movies, Orlando Bloom has killed more people with swords than any other person and bow and arrows in the 21st century.
Yeah, because think about it. When he had a gun in Black Hawk Down, he died right when he fell out of the helicopter.
Oh, yeah.
So he didn't even get a chance to shoot it.
Yeah, so when he has a bow and arrow or a sword,
yeah,
you're dead.
Yep.
He's like the Schwarzenegger of swords. And bow and arrows.
Like Legolas in Hobbit's just murdering everybody.
That's true.
So Legolas is
like
basically
sliding down staircases,
killing giant elephants.
Yeah.
So he's the 21st century commando.
Damn. Well, although Arnold Schwarzenegger did have a sword in Conan.
That's true.
And he hacked off an arm in Commando.
Wow. There you go. See? So he's had his fair share of sword
speaking
fights.
Of stabbing.
Yep.
I think Bloom still wins the head count, though.
Where's this one going?
Psycho.
Ooh. This is the last one we're talking about, right?
Yeah.
1960?
Now, so this was filmed in 60. There had been color films for a long time, but Hitchcock was like, this was such a crazy film to make at the time. No one wanted a part of it. And he actually made, like, if you think of inflation, after it made all the money, they said he made about $150 million because studios were just like, you know, what? We won't pay you much, but you can have some of the back end.
Jeez.
And the movie made so much money because they all thought it was, like, horrible. Like, they wouldn't let him film stuff for Disney because they thought it was, like, the film was abhorrent. And this movie was, like, really racy for 1960, and he filmed it for cheap. He filmed it on the back lot, and he used all of his television crew because he had his TV show at the time.
Yep.
So he shot a really cheap movie with Psycho. He just made the sprawling North by Northwest, and then he makes Psycho in black and white because he wanted to make like a hokey. He's like, well, if these movies are doing really well in the theater, I want to make one that's actually good.
Right.
And so it's like when a good director like Cronenberg or John Carpenter, they remake horror films actually good. So, like, you know, Psycho was one of the most influential movies ever made. The score, apparently he doubled the composer's pay, he gave the composer doubled his pay because he heard the score. Because he didn't want a lot of music, then he heard the score and he doubled it immediately.
Nice. I mean, the score, everybody knows the score to Psycho.
Yeah.
Was it dun
dun dun dun dun dun dun dun
dun dun dun?
But like he wanted it to be a TV show, a TV episode, and then the guy scored it. Herman scored it, and he was like, "Oh, it's gonna be a movie."
So. Yeah, I mean, I'm glad they made it a movie. I read the book, which it was a book first by Robert Bloch, and the book is not, it's not a long book. I think it's like less than 200 pages, and the movie's almost like beat for beat the book. It's like I read Rosemary's Baby, and the movie is almost like, I mean, they're taking dialogue out of the book, like straight out of the book, and that's how Psycho was too. It was just like almost beat for beat. There's only a few things that I remember were kind of like not in the movie. Maybe they were too racy for the movie. But like you said, this movie was pretty racy for 1960. It's showing Janet Leigh in her bra, like in the first scene.
Ooh.
It's showing a toilet, which was, I think, the first time they ever showed a toilet flush. Yeah.
And she had a, in the beginning, she had a white bra. And then when, after she stole the money, she had a black bra.
Ooh, getting a little darker after she steals the money.
Wasn't there like a bareback shot in the beginning of Rear Window? Like when they were panning over, you see.
Oh
like,
yeah, there was. There yeah, was. There yeah, was. The dancer.
I remember that being really hot.
Yeah, that was, you masturbated to that furiously.
That's why I could never get through the movie.
Yeah, you always stopped at that scene. Yeah. That's the only scene you've seen of Rear Window.
I love Rear Window.
Everyone else is looking up Red Tube, and John's over here
looking
beginning
up
of Rear Window.
I'm a simple man.
No, but yeah, Psycho, like the fact, I mean, obviously the biggest thing was having Janet Leigh die halfway through. Like this bigger actress, she dies halfway through the movie. And it's like, where do you go from there? Like that was never really done before. Like you don't think of killing off your main character like that.
It's like Sam Jackson dying.
It's not Game of Thrones. Yeah, it's not, like, it's not that or Game of Thrones. Yeah, Game of Thrones where every main character dies.
Yeah.
Or like, but Anthony Perkins, I think, is one of the most underrated. No, it's not underrated because everyone thinks it's amazing now, but it's one of my favorite performances is Anthony Perkins. That scene, there's a scene. So Marion Crane shows up. They have this really long conversation. He kills her. He hides the body, puts the thing in a lake. But this detective comes looking for Marion Crane because she owes this business and money. Mm-hmm. Was it detective? What, Milton? Abergast, I think, something like that.
Abergast, yeah.
And that scene, though, between him and Norman Bates is brilliant because Norman starts off all confident at first. But then, like, throughout these long takes, he just starts to, like, lose his story. His story changes. Mm-hmm. And then he can't recall things, but then he can recall him. But it's just such a great scene because he starts off all kind of, you know, almost really confident, and then he loses that through the conversation. And I think it's just one of the best, you know, performances I've seen. And it was a different kind of killer too. He wasn't Dracula or any of the Hammer horror films like that. Like he was this kind of squirrely skinny guy.
Yeah, that's the thing is, yeah, he's not this, like, murderous big guy carrying an axe or whatever. He's just a scrawny guy. And you actually, like, again, when he's, like, burying her car in the swamp and it's, like, slowly going down, but then it, like, stops, you almost get, like, kind of worried for him, like, oh, shit, they're going to find the car, like, if it doesn't go down. But then, like, finally it starts sinking lower, and then you kind of, like, he, like, eases a little bit where you can kind of tell, like, he's almost, like, kind of worried that it wasn't going to completely disappear into the swamp.
Yeah, and then you know what's pretty interesting about this movie is this movie, I wouldn't say, it's not like directly responsible, but it's a lot of directors, horror directors, hated the ending of this film. Like even Ebert hated it.
Yeah.
Because this psychiatrist comes in and basically explains away Norman Bates. And at the end, it's his, the mother talking while it's just on his face. Mm-hmm. So like all the mystery is destroyed.
Right.
And out of that, I mean, there were other influences, but John Carpenter made Halloween because he hated the ending of Psycho so much. That's why Michael Myers is such an unstoppable killing machine that has no backstory or personality. But because he hated the end of Psycho.
Do you hate the end of Psycho?
I think
that last 5 minutes?
But I'll tell you what. The final 10 seconds, that look on Anthony Perkins' face is so perfect.
Well, it has the overlay of the skull, right? Of his mother's skull.
Mm-hmm. And then he just smiles. Mm-hmm. Like that final shot leaves you on a high. So like you kind of forget that there's this weird dude talking about, you know, the killer and explaining everything away.
Right.
So for me, I think it ends on a high, but it nails the landing after a really rough final dive.
Well, and it's weird, like that is something that I've heard, like people kind of don't like that final explaining of who Anthony Perkins, like, you know, who Norman Bates is. But in the book, that's how it ends too. Like that was in the book, like almost verbatim. And that's why I think it's just in the movie. Like I think Alfred Hitchcock liked putting that in there where, like, I mean, you have that final shot of Anthony Perkins, and I think that kind of seals the whole thing. Like you're saying, it puts you on like that high where you're like, oh shit, like creepy overlay of the skull. And I think it's got an overlay of the car coming out, like the chains or whatever, pulling the car out of the swamp. And like that's kind of cool. Like that's a cool way to end it. It does kind of slow down a little bit with the explanation and everything, but that was in the book, so I'm assuming that's why he just kept it in there.
And I think he liked just sticking with what he had.
Right.
Like I think he did work with a lot of different writers too. I think he just liked, he had the material there, so he shot it.
Yeah.
And I don't know, a lot of people hate it. I think they hated it because it was so groundbreaking, and then it sort of let them down.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I never had that reaction. Like, I'm not going to go make a horror icon because I hated it so much.
Nah, I think still, like, overall, the movie is really good. But you know what you could always do is you could watch Gus Van Sant's remake, Psycho, which is just a glorious film starring Vince Vaughn, William H. Macy, Julian Moore, and Anne Heche.
With all the subtlety of a jackhammer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Shot remake.
It's weird. It was a shot-for-shot remake, but it just doesn't come close to the, in terms of the way it builds suspense. It just doesn't come close to the original.
I think it's just because you've seen the original and you know what to expect. So when it's shot-for-shot, you lose all of that credibility, like, of being any kind of suspenseful.
Yeah.
And not only that, it's like the only thing they did add, they, like, changed one thing, and that was to have Vince Vaughn masturbating while he's watching In Haste, which I think was in the book. So they added that in there, but everything else was just shot for shot.
And I know I keep quoting him. I have my own thoughts too. But Ebert said that Vince Vaughn's laugh, and he was trying to mimic Perkins' laugh in Psycho. But Perkins' laugh feels like a nervous tick.
Mm-hmm.
Like it kind of comes out of nowhere. It feels organic. But when Vince Vaughn does it, he's like, you know, 25 bucks for the room. it's not organic at all. It just feels really awkward. And I watched it again, and I was like, ugh. I didn't watch the whole thing.
Right.
But I sped to those parts, and I was like, oh, my gosh. Like, yeah. I appreciate that Vince Vaughn did it. Like, he tried.
They all tried. I mean, they all gave it their all. I mean, William H. Macy, I love the guy. He's great. I love Julianne Moore, too. Great actress. Yep. Not the best role for any of them, though.
Yeah. And I think they made a joke about it on Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, where he was just counting through the money, Gus Van Sant. Like, he was doing Good Will Hunting 2.
Oh, yeah.
And he was just, like, counting, like, yeah, I don't know. I thought that was funny.
Good Will Hunting 2, : how about them apples?
Yeah.
That's what I would call it.
Applesauce, bitch.
You don't have to go explore all of Hitchcock's films, but what three should they start with?
Disturbia.
Notorious, Psycho the 2009, yeah. And then Psycho Remake. Yeah. That's what John's picking.
I think that's good.
No, Mr. and Mrs.
Good.
Smith.
Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
With Brangelina.
Angelina, yeah. Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt.
Sure.
You go first, Mark. Let me think about this one.
Psycho.
So, yeah, for me, I'm putting North by Northwest up there.
Yeah, I like that. So Psycho, North by Northwest.
And then I would go something like, because that way you're getting a horror, you're getting more of like an action-y suspense. And then I say go more with like either Rear Window or, I don't know, Notorious maybe. I mean, there's a lot we didn't even talk about. Like, Shadow of a Doubt's a good movie. The Birds, I still think is like a decent movie. And then like Dial M for Murder is a really good movie. Really
it's
good
brilliant.
Mystery. Yeah.
Like, he loves keys, Hitchcock does.
I know,
that's
right?
For sure.
Yeah.
It's so hard. All right, so let's do Notorious.
Okay. Yeah, Notorious, I think, is a good because it's like, it's different. It's different than some of his other ones.
You're getting pretty much a sampling of everything. The Wrong Man, the horror.
Yeah.
And then, like, the
kind of
spy thriller love story.
They all have like a little bit of everything though, except for maybe Psycho. Psycho's more like horror, but everything else is like more mystery. North by Northwest is more mystery, action, suspense, but there's romance in it too. I mean, yeah, I think that would be like the best is if you do Notorious, North by Northwest, and Psycho.
I like it. It's those three movies, folks.
But definitely check out some of his other, I mean, there's just so many. I want to buy that Alfred Hitchcock Blu-ray collection, but it's pretty expensive.
How about this? You buy it.
Okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then you send me all the Blu-rays that you have extra.
Okay. Yeah. Actually, because I think I already have North by Northwest and Notorious, and those are in there, I think.
Hmm. Yep. So just send them my way. I'll come pick them up. I'm going to be down in November. I'll just come get them.
Okay. Just stop by. I'll give them to you. If I buy it. If I buy it.
I think you just do it. Just get it.
Maybe
right?
It'll make my Christmas wish list or Halloween wish list.
Halloween wish list. That way I can get it when I'm there.
Robert.
Not happening.
Yeah, you still have to buy me the Lost Complete Collection.
Not happening.
On Blu-ray.
Nope.
Yeah.
You owe me the Lost Complete Collection. Yeah.
Wait, are you guys serious? Because I'm sure that's not it. That can't be too expensive.
Yeah, I don't really want it at this point. Yeah, I don't really want it at this point.
All right, well, I'm going to get you both that for Christmas.
Sweet.
It's probably going to be like $29.99.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Shit. No, it's not.
So I think we reached the end of the podcast, but before we sign off, are there any plugs you want to make?
Yeah, I want you to... So there's a podcast that just came out from Shark Drop. It's where Robert and John basically go to junkyards, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
And they just see what they can find.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they don't know what they're doing.
Right.
But I love it.
We're on the second episode. What do we call it, John?
I found that doll head.
It's called Junkin', right?
Junkin'. And we always make a junk in the trunk joke at the very end.
Yeah. There's just too much.
It ends with the trunk slamming down.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a sound. We put our own sound effect of a trunk slamming down, and we go, oh, there's just too much junk in the trunk. And then we both laugh, and we sign off.
I just love that in the first episode, Lazabeth got tetanus.
Mm-hmm. And I rushed him to the hospital.
Yeah.
And he nearly died.
Yeah.
Well, when I tried to climb that tower of rusty cars, like...
I told you not to do it with your bare hands. And I told you not to lick anything. That was your fault. You can't lick cars, John.
How am I supposed to find the battery?
That's true. You can't lick batteries either.
I mean, I like the battery licking. Because, like Hitchcock says about suspense,
mm-hmm.
you know, I knew what was going to happen.
Oh, yeah. I knew he was going to get tetanus. I knew it.
And, like, oh, gosh, that was great. And I love that you got that road rash on your back.
Mm-hmm.
It was, like, 2 feet, wasn't it?
3 feet.
Yeah, you slid down. You tried
you
to decide
that,
to slide down a rusty
tanker.
Did you
ever get that cream, Robert? Did you ever get that cream for that?
What? Nah, I still got to go over to Walgreens. I got my my card. My prescription.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Listen to Junkers.
Junkers. episode 2 is out now. You can just go to sharkdropper.com and see all of the podcasts on there. We do a bunch, nonfiction and fictional stuff.
Yeah.
And listen to The Lamb, the large association of movie blogs. And he loved your first three picks, but he said your second two were garbage fails.
I don't remember I don't even remember what my team was.
You went jazz on that. You freestyled it. You just sort of felt it.
Like I usually do.
Yeah.
I think I went through The Rock, Space Jam. I think I like Fargo in there too or something.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of played it safe. You caught, but then you ended with some squirrely flicks.
I don't even remember what I ended it with. I think Space Jam was what I ended it with, right?
Yep.
Oh. You can't hate on me for Space Jam.
But,
yeah, you can.
No.
Well, we'll have 97, so.
Right, right.
That's right.
Okay. That does it for plugs. That does it for this episode. It was suspenseful.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
It was a lot of mystery. There was a...
Spoiler alert, we talked about Hitchcock. True. Should mention that.
Oh, yeah. Wait, what?
Yeah. Yeah. Just scroll back and listen to the whole episode.
Also, like, earlier in the podcast, I made a mention that M. Night Shyamalan, he's never made a comedy, right? Well, apparently he has. It was
his first movie.
No, it was like... it was his first movie, but he also made another one starring, like, Rosie O'Donnell and Julia Stiles. I think it was, like, Praying with Anger or something like that. I'm just like... So M. Night Shyamalan has made two comedies.
There you go. See? Don't write these people out.
I mean, if you're not counting like The Happening or like The Village.
I count those, so. He's made a lot of comedies.
Just movies that you can laugh at.
A lot of films, yeah, that are just laughable.
Sure. But yeah, I think that's a good note to end the podcast on. So, for my co-host, Mark Hoffmeyer.
Tetanus.
Robin Lamb. I'm your host, John Lawson. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you guys next time.
T-minus 5 seconds till shark drop. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Drop the shark! Go! Go! Go!
This podcast is a Shark Dropper Studios production.